Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 212. It's Monday, May 22nd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get started with a rather interesting story, as there's a debt ceiling showdown happening federally. And this is one of the few things that's on the table here, is clawing back some COVID money. It could have some interesting effects on public health. Here's one example of that. This from Politico. The debt ceiling deal could make America's STD problem much worse. Senior Biden administration officials and public health leaders are warning that debt ceiling negotiations around clawing back unspent COVID-19 money could have an unintended consequence, increasing sexually transmitted diseases. The potential cuts, one of the few seeming areas of agreement between House Republicans and the White House, could sap as much as $30 billion from state and local public health departments that are struggling to rebuild as COVID-19 wanes. Funding clawbacks would undermine work to slow the spread of syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV, and hepatitis, and leave the country weaker in the face of future pandemics. States and cities are counting on unspent COVID funds to support the ranks of local public health workers who test people for sexually transmitted infections, find and contact others who are exposed, and direct people to treatment, efforts crucial to limiting the spread of STDs. If they cut back that money, it'll set us back 15 years, said David Harvey, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. If that funding is taken away instantly, overnight, we will lose our ability to have the boots on the ground workforce to knock on doors, do outbreak investigations, navigate people through the healthcare system, and help people get tested and treated. It's really scary. Yet the cuts now under discussion could come at a particularly bad time in the fight against STDs, public health officials said. Already rising rates of syphilis spiked significantly during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a CDC report released in April, increasing 32% in 2021 to the highest total number of cases since 1950. Congenital syphilis cases, when the infection is transmitted from parent to fetus, surged more than 200% over the past 5 years, causing 220 stillbirth and infant deaths in 2021, the most fatalities since the early 1990s. COVID began spreading at a time when the nation's STD workforce was already struggling after two decades of flat funding, which, when adjusted for inflation and population growth, equated to a roughly 60% cut. The pandemic forced many of those same clinics and workers to shift from working on STDs to COVID, creating what he called a perfect storm that fueled our current sexually transmitted infection epidemic. Depending on how much more funding is cut in the final debt ceiling deal, public health departments could be forced to lay off staff from a workforce already shrunken by pandemic burnout, affecting efforts to respond to new outbreaks of Mpox in some U.S. cities, among other priorities. Without a permanent funding stream, we're very worried about a resurgence and the ability of the system to test, treat, and provide services that people need. We're heading into what may be a very complicated summer. Well, and as that story reached back into the COVID pandemic, let's do another one, a little look back here. This from Medical Express. Hundreds of millions of life years lost to pandemics, says World Health Organization. Nearly 337 million life years were lost in the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic, as millions of people died prematurely, the World Health Organization said last Friday. The pandemic has wreaked global devastation and officially killed nearly 7 million people, with the true figure believed to be closer to 20 million. It's like losing 22 years of life for every excess death, Samir Asma, WHO's assistant chief for data analytics, told reporters. So this is the interesting thing. Now, I reported during the pandemic, particularly in those first year or two, when you were looking at the years of potential life loss for each death, and it varies by different diseases. So that is, it's for instance, a little higher for cancer than it is for heart disease, but both of those are more in like the 12 to 15 year years of potential life loss per death, premature death. Whereas for this looking worldwide with COVID, talking 22 years of life for every excess death. So that's actually not something that's just picking off the weak and the elderly people who would have died anyways soon. And the thing that's, I think, striking about this, it surprised me a little bit, but it's a striking statistic, because one of the reasons why COVID didn't kill as many people is because the world population is a lot younger than the U.S. and industrialized countries. So that just means that a lot of younger people are getting it, but they're less likely to die. But those young people who do die lose a lot more years of potential life than somebody who's a lot older. And this was actually true in the U.S. in those first year or two, where actually if you looked at the percent of increase in excess death, it was actually higher in 20 and 30-somethings than it was in 70 and 80-somethings. So while a lot more of the death was happening among older folks, which is true with all during normal non-pandemic times, I mean, old people tend to die. So that's actually the typical situation that we're in. But if you look at it as a percentage of deaths, the increase in excess deaths from what would be expected, COVID actually, particularly early in the pandemic, actually hit young people even harder than older people. And this seems to be the case when you're looking at those first couple years of the pandemic worldwide, which the average age tends to be much younger. So for those of you trying to rewrite history saying that COVID wasn't a big deal, it was a huge deal. 22 years of life for every excess death, and about 20 million deaths worldwide in those first 2 years. Okay, well, in America, COVID really wrought a lot of COVID denial and vaccine, anti-vaccine sentiment. But here's actually some relatively good news regarding the skepticism around vaccines. This from CNN. Trust in childhood vaccines holds steady despite skepticism of COVID-19 vaccine survey finds. Nearly 9 out of 10 adults in the U.S. say the benefits of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine outweighs the risks, a share that remained unchanged since before the COVID pandemic, according to data published last Tuesday by the Pew Research Center. Only about 6 out of 10 adults say the same about COVID-19 vaccines. For the MMR vaccines, most adults say that the preventive health benefits are high and the risk of side effects are low. But for the COVID-19 vaccines, most rate the health benefits low and the risk level medium to high. Vaccine hesitancy may have ramped up during the pandemic, but it's not a new phenomenon, experts say. We've seen it with other vaccines because they're new technology. Sometimes we see it because parents underestimate the amount of disease that's really out there that they should be worried about. And the third is that when our messaging about the vaccine is confusing, said Dr. Buddy Creech, professor of pediatric infectious diseases and director of the vaccine research program at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. The Pew survey data shows that those who didn't get vaccinated against COVID have less positive views of the MMR vaccines in general, and there's a strong link between COVID-19 vaccination status and the likelihood a person will get the flu shot. Still, the findings suggest that adults in the U.S. make important distinctions across vaccines. Even among adults who did not get the COVID vaccine, about three-quarters say that when it comes to the MMR vaccines, the overall benefits outweigh the risks. About 70% of parents who didn't get the COVID vaccine said that their child had gotten the MMR vaccine. There are a few key distinctions between the COVID-19 vaccine and the MMR vaccines that could affect perceptions, Creech said. The COVID-19 vaccines were new and highly politicized, compared with the MMR vaccines, which have been around for generations. We appreciate and recognize that many of the vaccines that are in the childhood schedule have been there for decades. Our grandparents got it, our parents got it, we got it. They become part of the armory of the way we can prevent disease. The side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine were also more front and center. Once you get vaccinated against measles, you're good for the rest of your life. We don't have to keep vaccinating you every year or every 5 years, he said. For the majority of adults, it's probably been decades since they've had an MMR vaccine, or years since their child had one. And as the days go by, we don't remember those feelings of achiness or other side effects as much. Despite the steady trust in MMR vaccines overall, there are some signs of concern, particularly around requirements for children to be vaccinated to attend school. An early report from the CDC found that required vaccine coverage among kindergartners dropped for a second year in a row. For those enrolled in the 2021 to 2022 school year, coverage against measles was the lowest it's been in more than a decade. Most adults still support school vaccine requirements, but there was a significant drop from 82% to 70% over the past 4 years. The shift was driven mainly among Republicans, now with more than 4 out of 10 saying that parents should be able to decide whether to vaccinate their children. The CDC suggests that children get their first dose of MMR vaccine around age 1. 9 other vaccines are recommended by 15 months of age, with multiple doses required for many. However, about half of parents with children under 5 worry about whether all childhood vaccinations are necessary. This type of vaccine hesitancy is a luxury that we have in the West because these diseases, like measles and rubella, have largely been reduced, Creech said. But it's critical to meet parents where they are, including being able to explain the biology of the immune system and why hesitations about so-called overwhelming immune system don't need to be a concern. The one-size-fits-all approach doesn't really work, he said. We've really got to listen to what the individual concerns are and be able to speak to that based on the data that we have and the experience we've had with those vaccines. Okay, well, next up I have a story about walking in our community and the safety of that. And this is a really good case study, a good example of how infrastructure is a social determinant of our health, and that the built environment, which is not just an individual choice, but is a collective choice, can have a profound effect on our health. This from Medical Express. Americans walk less frequently and less safely compared to other countries, shows research. A stroll through international statistics about walking reveals the grim reality of foot travel in the United States. People walk less in the United States because it's more dangerous to walk here, and walking conditions are worse compared with other countries, said Ralph Bueller, professor of urban affairs and planning at Virginia Tech. So we're caught in a bit of a spiral that discourages walking and encourages driving in the U.S. For over a decade, Bueller and his co-authors have analyzed walking rates, pedestrian safety, and government policies across multiple industrialized nations, cities within the same nation, and multiple sections of the same city. A recent article published in the journal Sustainability updates the findings from prior work published in Transport Reviews, the American Journal of Public Health, and TR News. The findings show that overall Americans walk less than individuals in many other countries, while also having a higher fatality rate per mile walked. We are interested in figuring out how more people can walk while increasing pedestrian safety, said Bueller, who completed the project with John Pucher of Rutgers University. Walking doesn't have to be a means of transport of last resort. There are tools and policies out there to make it safer and more attractive. According to the study, Americans make fewer than half of the walking trips per day compared to Britons, yet are about 6 times more likely to be killed while walking per mile traveled. Those disparities remain relatively consistent on both fronts when the U.S. is compared to several other European countries, including Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands. The 11 countries studied from 1990 to 2020 all saw pedestrian fatalities per capita decrease over that span, but the numbers dropped substantially less in the U.S. Americans had a 26% decrease compared to 78% in the UK, for example. More troubling, while other countries continued to improve pedestrian safety from 2010 to 2020, the U.S. was the only country to have a rise, up 25%, in pedestrian fatalities. It's not only that walking is less safe in the U.S., the trends in walking safely are going in the wrong direction, Bueller said. Other findings of the study include walking rates being highest for short trips, women having a higher walking rate than men, and walking rates generally decreasing as income levels increase. The U.S. is also an outlier in the latter category. Americans are the only group where the highest income bracket walked more than the middle class. The researchers say it is likely due to the gentrification of many central cities since 2000, where walking is safe and convenient. Bueller said the U.S. has a long history of creating policies that promote driving while restricting pedestrians. The U.S. invented the term jaywalking. It doesn't exist in most other languages, Bueller said. The history is really fascinating because in the late 1890s and early 1900s, pedestrians were everywhere in the streets, but cars needed that space, so they sort of get pedestrians out of the streets with all those campaigns. And they were successful, of course, because no one today would say the street is a safe place for pedestrians. And that mindset has guided much of the country's infrastructure planning as it has grown during the past century. We have redesigned our communities around the automobile, and a lot of our engineering guidelines for roads have been built to facilitate car movement, he said. Roadway designers don't want to delay vehicles, and guess what? Pedestrian-friendly amenities like crosswalks delay cars. It's not so much that the guidelines are purposely anti-walking, they are pro-driving, but they do at the same time making walking less attractive. Based on the successes of other countries, a study suggests steps governments could take to promote safe walking. Steps towards better designs. A cultural shift that better prioritizes pedestrians during the roadway planning process is needed. This could include the incorporation of networks of clearly marked, well-lit sidewalks and crosswalks, and safety islands built into intersection corners and medians, as well as rethinking road placement and de-emphasizing designing for speed. We in the U.S. walk less, even though there are a large number of trips that would be short enough, Bueller said. For example, northern New Jersey has roughly the population density of the Netherlands, but it's been planned for cars. So across the street, you can see your destination, but because in between there's a six-lane roadway with no crosswalk, it's very dangerous or impossible to get there. Steps towards better land use. Along with more pedestrian-friendly street signs, thinking through the creation of more walkable communities should include revamping zoning laws and regulations to allow for more mixed-use spaces. The land use really matters, Bueller said. If we keep defining neighborhoods as places without corner stores, daycares, doctor's offices, and things of daily necessity, we're forcing people to drive because distance will be long and there really will not be a choice. Steps towards better driving habits. Lower speed limits enforced by both police and traffic cameras, as well as tightened laws related to drunk and distractive driving, could greatly benefit safety for both drivers and walkers. Also needed is a revision of laws and their enforcement to put more responsibility on drivers. If a pedestrian gets hit, we often sort of blame the victim, Bueller said. We have to put the responsibility of avoiding that on the people who operate the two-ton machines rather than the people who are walking and have no physical protection around them. Steps towards better transportation education. Many countries with safer walking rates also have more restrictive driving regulations. Similar efforts, compounded with more proactive education programs related to both walking and driving for youth, could greatly increase the overall safety of both activities. One of the most dangerous jobs in the U.S. is that of crossing guard, Bueller said. So it's very dangerous, even around schools, for kids to walk to schools. As a result, parents decide to drive them to school, and then there are even more cars driving around those schools. What steps can you take? As the warmer weather makes walking more attractive, it also provides an opportunity to play a critical role in making communities safer for foot travel. People who are out and walk daily, they know about dangerous situations. They know about the sidewalks missing links. They know about the traffic signals that don't work, Bueller said. They need to talk to their local politicians, their town and city engineers, because what we're finding again and again is those folks don't really know what's out there. Now, I would actually put the onus on those engineers to actually include in their processes talking to people who are actually pedestrians. And as a regular cyclist, somebody who doesn't own a car, I've definitely experienced this firsthand. The world is not built for pedestrians and bikers. And even when I do drive a car, if you're paying attention, you'll note that it's almost impossible to drive a car without getting in the way and violating rights away of pedestrians and bikers. Okay, well, another story that has to do with injuries. This is from Medical Express. Rate of fatal falls among U.S. seniors doubled in 20 years. Older Americans are dying of falls at more than double the rate of 20 years ago, with women, men, and all racial groups showing increases, according to a new study. In 2020, the study found just over 36,500 Americans aged 65 and up died of a fall-related injury. That was up from roughly 10,000 deaths in 1999. It's well known that falls are the leading cause of injury death among older Americans, and that the problem is growing. Far more older Americans take a fall every year, many of whom do not tell their doctor unless an injury forces them to seek care. Figures from the CDC tell the story. About one quarter of older Americans fall each year. Roughly 3 million end up in the emergency room, and more than 800,000 have to be hospitalized, most often for a head injury or broken hip. This translates into about $50 billion per year in medical costs, the CDC estimates. For one, more older adults these days are surviving serious medical conditions like heart attack and stroke, which is a good thing, but living with the after effects of those conditions can put people at increased risk of falls. Another factor is that many older adults are now taking multiple medications, some of which, or combinations of which, can cause dizziness or other side effects that contribute to falls. In its fall prevention advice, the CDC recommends that older adults ask their doctor or pharmacist to review their medications, including over-the-counter medications, to see if any may increase their risk of falls. It is also important for older adults to regularly have their eyesight and hearing checked, since such impairments in either are risk factors for falls. As for where older adults fall, other research shows that many do occur in medical or long-term care facilities, but a large and growing proportion happen in the home. Older adults and families can take a number of simple steps to make the home safer, installing grab bars in bathrooms, getting rid of small throw rugs and other trip and slip hazards, having handrails on both sides of staircases, and making sure the house is well lit are among them. It's possible that older adults and families could work with an occupational therapist, that is, health professionals who, among other things, can come to the home and recommend safety modifications. And next up in some chronic disease news, this from Medical Express, investigation unveils increase in deaths from diabetes and cardiovascular disease. After an initial decline in diabetes and cardiovascular disease-related deaths, researchers from Emory and other institutions have noted a reversal of the trend, with mortality rates increasing from 2014 to 2019, according to a new study published in the American Journal of Medicine. Diabetes is a significant risk factor for heart disease complications and has been on the rise in recent years. More than 37 million adults in the United States, about 15% of the population, are known to be living with this condition, with potentially more whose condition has gone undiagnosed. With an eye towards improving patient outcomes, research has performed an updated epidemiological analysis to define the current magnitude of the problem. They found that diabetes can double or even quadruple the risk of heart events in patients. Diabetes also causes a threefold increase in cardiovascular mortality. This analysis revealed additional patterns in mortality over the past 20 years, including males and non-Hispanic black adults were more often affected than other demographic subgroups. There was an alarming rise in diabetes and cardiovascular disease-related mortality rates in younger adults, that is, those aged 25 to 54, and middle-aged adults 55 to 69 during the latter part of the study period. There was a higher burden of mortality in rural areas than in urban areas, and this difference widened with the progression of time. And next up, get to a couple mental health stories. This first one from The Hill, Depression rates hit new high in Gallup polling. The rate of Americans reporting they have been diagnosed with depression at some point in their life reached a new high in 2023. A new Gallup poll published last Wednesday reported that 29% of Americans said they have been diagnosed with depression at least once through their lifetime, a slight uptick from 27% reported in 2022. The share of Americans who reported they currently have or are being treated for depression also hit a new high of 18%. The poll found lifetime depression rates among black and Hispanic Americans were also increasing. The share of black and Hispanic Americans responding they have been diagnosed with depression surpassed those respondents who are white, which the poll noted have historically reported higher rates of depression. The new poll noted the rate of women reporting they have been diagnosed with depression at least once has risen nearly twice the rate of men since 2017. More than one-third of women reported in 2023 they have been diagnosed with depression at some point in their life, while 20% of men reported the same. Women and all people ages 18 to 29 are the two groups that reported the highest rates of currently having or being treated for depression. Nearly 24% of women responded they are being treated for depression, and 25% of adults age 18 to 29 reported the same response. The report cited the COVID-19 pandemic as a reason for increasing rates of depression among women and young people since 2017, noting women were more likely to lose their jobs during the pandemic and were more likely to work in the medical field. The poll said young adults were more likely to experience loneliness during the pandemic, which could be related to depression. Young adults, in turn, are more likely to be single and to report loneliness, particularly so during the pandemic. They also need more social time to boost their mood than older adults, something directly impacted by COVID-19. Daily experiences of sadness, worry, and anger, all of which are closely related to depression, are highest for those under 30 and those with lower income levels. Well, and next up, I have a particularly interesting mental health story, which gets to the fact that our life situations can have a profound effect on our health. This from The Hill. Investigation into suicides on U.S. Navy ship reveals service failures, turns eyes towards leadership. An investigation into a string of suicides of U.S. Navy sailors assigned to the USS George Washington has revealed failures in the working and living conditions at naval shipyards, leading to recommendations for improvements in mental health services, food, and housing. The conditions experienced by those assigned to the USS George Washington and Marmaduke are not the result of any act or inaction by any single leader. Collectively, Navy senior leadership, officer and civilian, let our standards slip. And in so doing, we let our people down, said Navy Chief Admiral Michael Gilday and Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro in a memo. So this is an example that, you know, when your living conditions and working conditions get so bad, you know, it actually increases suicide. It's not just something between the ears. It's actually a response to the life conditions that we're subject to. And it's particularly ironic since, you know, we consider, you know, military service members as, quote, kind of essential workers. And, you know, we talk about how much we highly value people in the service and that kind of thing. Yet we can't even give them living and working conditions enough to keep their suicide rates, at least at a normal, quote, normal level. And there are a lot of cultural issues tied up in that. And this next story gets at one, particularly capitalism as a way of profiting off the poor mental health of people. This from MedPage Today. Profiteering off the body insecurity of teens. Body dissatisfaction and muscle dysmorphia are rising among adolescent males, and the majority of boys in the U.S., nearly 60%, report altering their diet in pursuit of muscularity. Propelling them along their dangerous pursuit of muscularity is the dietary supplements industry, which targets boys and young men with deceptive disinformation about its sometimes dangerous products. Muscle-building supplements and the culture surrounding them are causing serious damage to kids' mental and physical health and will only continue to wreak havoc if left unchecked. The supplements industry can and must be stopped. I heard I should take a pre-workout protein shake to build muscle faster, which I've been doing every day, but my body isn't changing. What else should I take? Pediatricians, coaches, and parents are hearing questions like this more and much too often from teen boys. Sadly, teens feel increasing pressure to strive for the extreme muscularity they see in Hollywood heroes or the 2 million plus hashtag men's fitness posts on Instagram. What's more, the internalization of the muscular ideal has shown to be directly related to depressive symptoms and low self-esteem in adolescents. This is particularly alarming when coupled with the current mental health crisis teens face in the U.S. More than half of boys, 55%, and a third of teen girls use protein powders. It's not much of a surprise to see these high numbers when muscle-building supplements are so easy for teens to buy at local stores, gyms, and online. That, coupled with the relentless and deceptive marketing of muscle-building supplements, has led to high rates of use among adolescents. This is deeply concerning given that it's widely known that many unscrupulous manufacturers lace their products with illicit steroids, excessive stimulants, and experimental drugs not approved for human use. As recently as April of this year, the FDA came out with another strong warning about the widespread problem of muscle-building supplements illegally laced with selective androgen receptor modulators. These act similarly to testosterone and anabolic steroids and are linked with elevated risk of heart attack, stroke, liver injury and failure, psychosis, testicular shrinkage, and erectile dysfunction. The FDA particularly calls out influencers and vendors on social media who target teens with their false promises and deceptive messaging, leading young people to mistakenly believe the products are safe and healthful. Few teens or parents realize the use of muscle-building supplements come with serious risk. I see and treat too many teens who have added protein supplements to their daily routines, often using them multiple times a day. Some have developed muscle dysmorphic disorder, a serious mental health condition, and more boys these days feel they don't measure up if they aren't hypermuscular. Protein powder use in adolescents can also serve as a gateway to later steroid use. A recent study found teen boys who use protein powders were twice as likely as other boys to start using illicit anabolic steroids and other similar dangerous substances as young adults. The findings are even scarier for girls. Girls who use protein powders as teens were 5 times as likely as other girls to start using steroids or other similar substances. Unfortunately, the companies that sell these products crank out so many false and misleading claims that many kids and parents fall for their deception. But even leading authorities from the American Academy of Pediatrics to the National Athletic Trainers Association strongly caution against youth, athletes, and consumers of any age using these products. Given the weight of the evidence and the consensus among medical and sports authorities that these products are harmful for kids, many might rightly wonder how these products could still be legal to sell to children. Hopefully this will soon change in New York and Massachusetts, thanks to proposed legislation that prohibit the sale of dangerous over-the-counter supplements for muscle building to minors. But, like big tobacco, the deep-pocketed supplements industry is flooding state houses with their lobbyists, sowing lies and confusion about their products to keep lawmakers from acting. In response, in both states, pediatricians, parents, and youth advocates are joining forces to put pressure on lawmakers to push back against a relentless industry that profits from the body insecurities of teens. The voices of pediatricians speaking out about the harm done to young people will be vital to bolstering protections for children from these predatory products. The time has come for necessary and common sense action by lawmakers. Put people before profits and keep these dangerous supplements out of kids' hands. And as a public health nutritionist, I would just like to add for emphasis, we suffer from excess protein consumption in this country way, way, way more often than too little protein. If you eat a good balanced diet, you are not going to need to have protein supplements. The big rate limiting factor in building muscle is how much exercise you do. Particularly muscle building exercise, isotonic, you know, like weightlifting, that type of thing. But protein is really just something that they're just trying to sell you to make money. Okay, well, another dietary related note, this from Food Politics blog. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, conflict of interest disclosed, sort of. In a strange partnership, the Nutrition Coalition and the Center for Science and the Public Interest are jointly complaining about the way the USDA and Health and Human Services have, quote, disclosed conflicts of interest among members of the 2025 to 2030 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. Why strange? Because the Nutrition Coalition has long urged relaxations on advice about dietary fat, where Center for Science and Public Interest has long urged restrictions. Why disclosed, in quotes? Because the agency's disclosure statements list the combined conflicts for the entire group, and this is a large group, not for individual members of the committee. Because they are all jumbled together, you have to look hard to pull out the genuine conflicts. Relationships with committee members with food companies with vested interests in the outcomes of the guidelines. The Nutrition Coalition points out that the USDA and the Health and Human Services Department are failing to comply with a National Academies of Science report calling for publicly posting financial and non-financial biases and conflicts of interest of committee members. Recognize the significance of the first ever systematic review of the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee's financial ties. That review found 95% of the 2020 Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee members had at least one tie with a food or pharmaceutical company, and half had 30 such ties or more. You heard that right. Of the previous advisory committee, half of the members had 30 or more conflict of interest ties. Yikes. Well, that story just goes to show that science is really hard. And this next story, which talks about prostate cancer screening, talks about how kind of opting out of having well-developed guidelines can actually lead you somewhere which is not particularly good. So this is from Medical Express. Prostate cancer, quote, test by request policies drives overdiagnosis and inequity with minimal benefit, argue experts. Most high-income countries, including the U.S., do not have a national prostate cancer screening program, but instead allow men without symptoms to get a prostate-specific antigen, the PSA test, if they wish, after talking with their doctor. But experts writing in the British Medical Journal argue that these shared decision policies have led to high rates of PSA testing and clear medical harm, with minimal benefit and inequity. Andrew Vickers and an international group of colleagues argue that high-income countries should either implement a comprehensive risk-based approach to PSA testing, designed to reduce overdiagnosis and overtreatment, or discourage PSA testing through a clear recommendation against screening, along with policies that make it hard to obtain a test without specific symptoms. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men and the second leading cause of cancer death in men. But it's still not clear whether the benefits of PSA screening, as currently practiced, outweigh the harms of overdiagnosis and overtreatment when low-risk tumors that would never cause symptoms or shorten life are detected and treated unnecessarily. But the authors argue that relying on shared decision-making to guide PSA testing has led to high rates of PSA testing, particularly in older men, who are most likely to be harmed by screening and the least likely to benefit. So health screenings can be very good, but it can definitely be overdone. And America is really good about doing too little of some things it needs to do on that end of the spectrum and too much of things it don't really need to do. So we need to standardize that with some good science-based guidelines. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, hopefully to counter that last story there, want to do a story where developing good guidance can be helpful. This from the Washington Post. CDC guidance opens path to better indoor air quality. The coronavirus pandemic taught Americans to wear good masks, avoid big crowds, and test often to stop the spread of viral illness. Also crucial, but not fully understood early in the crisis, is that indoor air quality is key to reducing viral transmission. Fortunately, the CDC released last Friday pathbreaking new guidance to improve ventilation in buildings with specific targets that can make a difference the next time a novel virus strikes, or even when the bad flu is going around. Although it wasn't widely understood when the pandemic began, virus particles spread person to person when exhaled in both larger droplets that fall to the ground and smaller aerosols that hover for hours. Clouds of virus particles do not disperse easily in stagnant indoor air. Just recall the dark days of the pandemic when the virus stalked cruise ships, church choirs, prisons, meatpacking plants, and other tight enclosed spaces. Outdoors, the air moves faster and virus particles dissipate more quickly. Most buildings in the United States were constructed to meet minimal air quality standards, unsuited to mitigating respiratory disease. According to Joseph Allen, an associate professor and director of the Healthy Buildings Program at the Harvard School of Public Health, this sick building problem long predates the pandemic, but the pandemic experience is helping to accelerate change. It showed that simple improvements such as bringing in more outside air, upgrading filtration, and enhancing ventilation slow disease spread. Healthy buildings can also reduce the transmission of other respiratory ailments, including influenza and RSV, can help reduce asthma exacerbations and allergy symptoms, and can improve cognitive functioning for people working and studying in them. The CDC previously recognized the importance of improving air quality, but the public health agency published revised guidance for the first time, prescribed a specific target of 5 air exchanges per hour. This means supplying or exhausting the amount of air in a space 5 times over the course of an hour. The target can be met in different ways, with a combination of outside air and improved filtration and ventilation. While the new target will not guarantee totally safe air in any space, the CDC says it reduces the risk of exposure to germs and other harmful air contaminants. Likewise, most buildings in the past were equipped with filters known as MERV 8 that are designed to protect equipment and capture about 20% of airborne particles. The CDC is now calling for buildings to install MERV 13 that can capture 80 to 90% of particles. Also significant, the standard setting at American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers has completed and published a draft of its first ever standard for maintaining healthy indoor air quality, with a final draft due this summer. Although substantial pandemic-era funding remains available, a CDC survey of U.S. schools conducted from August to December last year found only a patchwork of ventilation improvements. Many schools were built to accommodate only 3 air exchanges per hour. Mr. Allen suggests that buildings first must be given a tune-up to check performance, then maximize outdoor air and upgrade filters, which are inexpensive. Ultimately, the issue is not only about particles and filters. It will be up to businesses, workers, students, parents, scientists, and everyone else to demand change in the buildings in which we spend so much of our lives. Do you know the air exchanges per hour at your workplace or classroom? CDC is now giving us a yardstick to measure that by. Americans should use it. Okay, I want to close the show with two very interesting articles on the environmental front. First up from Politico, Governor Lujan Grisham, I will use every tool in my toolbox to block nuclear waste storage in New Mexico. Democratic New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham put the Biden administration on notice last Thursday that she will use every tool in her toolbox to block attempts to build interim storage of nuclear waste in her state. I think other states need to step up. I think other solutions need to step up, she said during Politico's first ever energy summit. And I'll take it as a compliment. This is a highly scientific state that does a lot of innovation with two of the energy department's national labs right here, but don't expect us to always do the heavy lifting here. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission recently issued a long-awaited license to Holtec International for the construction and operation of an interim nuclear waste storage facility in New Mexico, despite pushback from Lujan Grisham and other state officials who have cited public health, economic, and environmental justice concerns over the project. She also signed a law this year that prohibits the issuance of state permits for the construction or operation of a disposal facility for spent fuel or high-level waste unless the state has consented and a permanent repository is in operation. The U.S. currently has no permanent repository for the radioactive waste from the fleet of nuclear power plants that provide about one-fifth of the nation's electricity. No, none, ever. We've never had a permanent way of dealing with radioactive waste. And, as I reported on a little bit more last week, the U.S. is planning on building new nuclear power plants. So while sometimes they put it off as some kind of green, low-carbon way, nuclear power is not safe. And the radioactive waste, this could be something where people look back and say, roll their eyes for literally 1,000 generations about a foolish mistake mortgaging our children's and great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren's lives. Okay, I want to close out the regular reporting with one on the plastic crisis, and this is based on a UN report, this from Wired. The plastic crisis finally gets emergency status. Humanity's relationship with plastic isn't just broken, it's absurd. Now we're churning out 1 trillion pounds of it a year, an altogether more stunning figure when you consider that the material is ultra-lightweight by design. Less than 10% of that is recycled, while the rest ends up in landfills, leaks into the environment, or is burned. And that dysfunctional relationship is getting exponentially worse, as plastic production could triple by 2060. The problem is massive, demoralizing, and ostensibly impossible to fix. But today, the United Nations Environmental Program is dropping an urgent report on the extraordinary environmental and human costs of plastic pollution, along with a roadmap for the world to take action. With several strategies working in concert, like production cuts and more reuse of plastic products, the report finds that humanity might reduce that pollution 80% by 2040. The roadmap lands just weeks ahead of the second round of negotiations for an international treaty on plastics, which scientists and anti-pollution groups are hoping for results in a significant cap on production. The report emphasizes the devastating price of our civilization's addiction to plastic, particularly when it comes to human health costs of plastic. So endocrine disruption, cognitive impairments, cancers, says Stephen Sohn, Deputy Director of the Industry and Economy Division at the United Nations Environmental Program and a lead author of the report. When you take those along with the cleanup costs of plastic pollution, you get in the range of $300 to $600 billion a year. This report is a message of hope. We are not doomed to incurring all these costs. In fact, the report notes, with action on plastic pollution, we might avoid $4.5 trillion in costs by 2040. This roadmap builds on another alarming report released earlier this month, which found that of the 13,000 known chemicals associated with plastics and their production, at least 3,200 have one or more hazardous properties of concern. 10 groups of these chemicals are of major concern, such as PFAS and phthalates. A particular toxicity are a wide range of chemicals in plastics and endocrine-disrupting properties, which short-circuit the hormone system, even in very low doses, leading to obesity, cancer, and other diseases. These are the costs that are going to manifest in human health, in environmental destruction, in marine litter pollution, Stone says. Those are costs that fall on everyone, but the consumer of plastic doesn't doesn't take pay for it. Neither does the producer. So there's a massive market failure. Plastic is, at the end of the day, a highly toxic material that's infiltrated every aspect of our daily lives. The goal, above all others, should be to stop manufacturing so much of this stuff. So the new roadmap calls for eliminating unnecessary plastics, like the single-use variety. But the challenge is that plastic remains absurdly cheap to produce. Its many external costs be damned. This roadmap is headed in the right direction, but must go much further to curb new plastic production, says Diana Cohen, CEO and co-founder of Plastic Pollution Coalition. We are glad to see an emphasis on a reduction in reuse, which are key elements of solutions to plastic pollution, as these actions can most rapidly help us diminish plastic production. Missing in the report is requiring industrial and corporate entities that produce material items to stop making more toxic fossil fuel plastic, full stop. In addition to reducing production, the report argues, the world must improve recycling systems, which alone could reduce plastic pollution 20% by 2040. But recycling in its current form is problematic for a number of reasons. For one, the recycling rate in the United States is now just 5% of plastic waste. The U.S. and other developed nations have long shipped millions upon millions of pounds of the plastic waste they can't profitably recycle to developing countries, where bottles and bags and wrappers are often burned in open pits and escape into the environment. A core issue is that over the years, plastic products have gotten much more complicated and therefore much less recyclable. Nowadays, food pouches might have layers of different polymers, or a product might be half plastic, half paper. By agreeing and then imposing design rules that allow, for instance, a limited number of polymers or a limited number of chemical additives that play well within the system, that already improves heavily the economics of recycling, said Laurent Canals, head of the Secretariat of the Life Cycle Initiative at the United Nations Energy Program and lead coordinator of the report. That makes recycling much more profitable because it will take much less to bring those materials back into the economy. However, even recycling that's done properly comes at a huge environmental cost. A study published earlier this year found that a single facility might emit 3 million pounds of microplastic a year in its wastewater, which flows into the environment. The upside, at least, is that the facility would have released 6.5 million pounds of microplastic had it not installed filters. So there's at least a way to mitigate partially the pollution. But these tiny particles have now corrupted the entirety of the planet, including a broad range of organisms. And generally speaking, as plastic production is increasing exponentially, microplastic pollution is increasing in lockstep. In that sense, then, recycling is making the plastic pollution problem worse. Plastics were not designed to be recycled, and recycling it only reintroduces toxic chemicals and microplastics into the environment and our bodies, said Cohen. The report authors even go so far to acknowledge that even if it is achievable, a circular economy of plastics would be decades in the making, and even under the best scenario, following the roadmap as outlined would lead to approximately 136 million metric tons of plastic flowing into landfills, incinerators, and the environment to cause pollution in the year 2040. That is an enormous and an unacceptable amount of plastic. Really, recycling allows the plastics industry to keep making all the plastic at once under the guise of sustainability. If you had an overflowing bathtub, you wouldn't just run for the mop first. You'd turn off the tap, said Jacqueline Savitz, chief policy officer for the conservation nonprofit Oceana, who wasn't involved in the report. Recycling is the mop. Another strategy highlighted in the new report is extended producer responsibility, in which manufacturers don't just make the stuff and wipe their hands of it. The plastics industry has long promoted recycling, even though it has known that the current system doesn't work, because it makes you, the careless, quote, careless consumer, responsible for pollution. Extended producer responsibility puts the burden back on the industry, forcing producers to, say, implement systems that take bottles back and reuse them. Additionally, the new report notes countries might impose a tax on plastic, which would make it more expensive for manufacturers to churn out virgin plastic. Governments would then use that money to fund recycling programs and other mitigation measures to reduce plastic pollution. The costs that are externalized to society are actually put up front. And then recycling materials are much more competitive with the virgin materials. There will be a tremendous benefit for keeping plastics in play longer. Another way to keep plastics in circulation is encourage reuse. So instead of having to recycle a single-use water bottle, ideally people would have their own reusable bottles to fill over and over. Instead of buying shampoo in a plastic bottle each time, people might visit refill stores. Combine such reuse initiatives with reduced plastic pollution by 30%. the new report finds. It does require systems and investment, but it has the potential to be a big economic opportunity. New companies could start out small, but could end up being sort of the Amazon of reuse. Finder report calls for careful replacement of certain plastic products, using paper or compostable materials instead, for instance. Careful means that we wouldn't want to widely deploy some sort of plastic alternative that ends up just as non-toxic. This is already a problem, as plastic producers swap out known toxic chemicals, like bisphenol A, aka BPA, for similar chemicals that may be just as toxic, if not more so. So regrettable substitution, as scientists call it, is a real problem. The good news, at least, is that plastic pollution is finally being elevated to emergency status in the international community. The fact there is a consensus on this as an issue by all countries, to me, means we have a tremendous opportunity, says Stone. It's our job to get the science out there, so if the people can see the numbers and understand what the stakes are right now, because plastics pollution is a time bomb, essentially, and we need to deal with it now. Okay, well, that all brings us to our last segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I reported on this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 22 articles this week. First up, Baltimore children who moved from high poverty to low poverty areas saw their asthma improve. Really good example how social determinants like basic housing or perhaps better schools, safer environment, all kinds of, you know, reduce your stress, all that kind of stuff, is a very basic social determinant in public health. Bonus article two, 1 in 5 seniors report cost-related medication non-adherence. I like how they use the term non-adherence. I'd say it's our non-adherence to taking care of our seniors. Bonus article three, postpartum women face high burden of medical debt. As we all know, the more you interface with the medical system, the more likely you're subject to medical debt. And women, pregnancy and postpartum, face more medical use and therefore more medical debt. Bonus article four, American women need more maternity leave, access to pregnancy care, says poll. No surprise there. This poll has a lot of good information if you're interested in that topic. Bonus article five, hospitals in two states denied an abortion to a miscarrying patient. Investigators say they broke federal law. So with anti-abortion laws basically criminalizing healthcare, we're actually getting to the point where we're bumping up into other laws and we're violating federal laws for basically criminal negligence for not providing care for people who need it. Article 6, new draft recommendations for mammograms takes a one-size-fits-all approach. This is basically a follow-up story. If you missed the reporting last week and if you're interested in the new recommendations for mammogram screening, the good article to check out. Article 7, after decades of neglecting women athletes, sports and exercise medicine is finally catch up. So a little bit of good news that the sexism in research, in this case about sports and exercise medicine, is actually taking a turn for the better, and we're seeing more research that applies to women, but there's a long way still to go. Okay, a few environmental stories here. Article 8, researchers identify 10 pesticides toxic to neurons involved in Parkinson's. And a related story, 9, chemical exposure may raise your risk for Parkinson's, says a large veteran study. So these are two different classes of chemicals, both shown to raise Parkinson's risk. Article 10, a ticking time bomb. Environmental group says Pentagon moving too slowly to stop toxic cleanup at military bases. So that one study on the Parkinson's was at military, people who had spent time at military bases. But this one, actually, the ticking time bomb, is really referring to the PFAS, those forever chemicals, that also were widely polluting on military bases. A little bit of a good news how-to story, bonus article 11, three families vowed to stop a killer chemical. Here's how they did it. So they experienced this toxicity through paint removers, and they worked to get rid of it and ban it. Article 12, a simple way to prevent heaps of methane pollution, composting. So this is like 38 to 84% reduction in methane release by composting at home rather than just dumping it into a landfill. Bonus article 13, an AI chatbot may be your next therapist. Will it actually help your mental health? The short answer is probably not. Bonus article 14, state lawmakers eye forced treatment to address overlap in homelessness and mental illness. So these two stories next to each other are a really good example. So, you know, the way we deal with things in this country. So we'll give you an AI chatbot to be your therapist, which probably doesn't really work, or we'll lock you up with forced treatment, which has been shown to have many problems. If you're interested in that issue, great, great story. Bonus article 15, something weird is going on with melatonin as pediatric overdoses have increased by 530% over the past decade. So melatonin is often seen as kind of harmless. It's actually a hormone. But also this gets to the fact that like dietary supplements are not well regulated. The manufacturers don't even necessarily have the amount that's on the label. And that if you want your kids to go to sleep or your kids are, you know, stressed out or whatever, you might, you know, dose them up, or they just give them, they have melatonin in gummies, so younger kids just eat them as candy. So yeah, something weird going on. Article 16, WHO warns against using artificial sweeteners. A good overview of the research that artificial sweeteners are probably a good thing to avoid. Article 17, bitten by a tick, what's my risk of getting sick? So if you want to know about tick diseases, and when you may need to seek health care, this is a good article. Bottom line is if you can get the ticks off quickly before they start feeding, that's the best thing to do. Article 18, those at high risk of Mpox should get two doses of vaccine, CDC says. So that's a follow-up from a story I did last week that getting into the kind of the gay pride season, men who have sex with men should probably dose up with both doses of Mpox, because even if they got it last year, it doesn't seem that perhaps it's the immunity's waning. Article 19, appeals court pauses ruling that threatened free preventive health care. So I reported that a number of weeks back, and that could be disastrous chaos to get rid of free preventive health care, but it looks like that's been stayed for the time being. Bonus article 20, why is a curable disease still allowed to kill millions? And that disease would be TB or tuberculosis. I've reported on this before, but it's still a really great question. Why is a curable disease still allowed to kill millions? Partly because it happens in the poorer parts of the world. Bonus article 21, the pandemic really didn't change much about American sickness behavior. This is a great long read just about, it gets at the fact that while our kind of stoic work through everything, you know, is an attitude that we have, but also the fact that we don't have paid sick leave and stuff kind of prevents us from changing our behavior too much. And lastly, bonus article 22, people in the U.S. think they are better than they actually are. People in Asia don't. A case study of why research bias in weird societies, weird standing for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic societies, distorts our understanding of the world. Great long read. You can read this and other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.